The following episode of The Speakeasy has been brought to you by TechServe. This January, responsibly dispose of all your old electronics at one of 10 e-waste recycling events held across four boroughs of New York City, hosted by TechServe and the Lower East Side Ecology Center. Computers, printers, monitors, and lots of other electronics are being accepted for safe and proper recycling. Visit www.techserve.com/recycling for more information and drop-off location details.
Boys, I'm mellow as a honeydew. Yeah, that cat is high.
Hello, welcome to The Speakeasy with Damon Bolte on the Heritage Radio Network. My guest today is Brian Miller, legendary bartender and all-around amazing mixologist, if I can call you that. I hope you don't mind.
I'll let you get away with it.
All right. We won't say that again. How's it going?
Good, man. Happy to be here.
Great. Welcome to the show. You've worked in several cities and several different bars, many of them being heavily pressed and a lot of your recipes being heavily pressed. And to most of the listeners that know about current bar culture and cocktails and spirits, your name won't be any mystery to them. You've worked with a lot of different spirits brands, won many competitions, and worked at some of the leading cocktail bars in the United States and the world. And
it's very nice of you to say.
Yeah, well, it's nice of you to be here. So you're originally from Seattle.
Yeah.
And you moved here after Seattle.
I moved here pretty much right after I graduated from college at Washington State. When I was like 19, I came out to New York and I visited my brother Danny, who's a photographer out here, and had like the best experience of my life. Totally blown away. One of my highlights was I got to see Les Paul play
cool
at the Village Underground. And when I came back, I was like a totally changed person. And my dad, when I graduated college, and I was like, the first thing I was going to do was like, I'm moving to New York. My dad was like, I think the worst thing I ever let you do was go to New York. And I was like, actually, I think that's the best thing you ever let me do.
Yeah. Cool. Were you bartending during college, or was this something that you started doing afterwards?
No, I didn't really start bartending until I moved to New York. The first job I ever got here, a restaurant job, I should say, I ever got here was I worked at this place called Grove over on the corner of Bleecker and Grove, and it was just a great little place, kind of like a little French bistro. And I started off as a food runner, and I actually didn't even know what the hell a food runner was. And of course, I found out I was literally running up and down a flight of stairs every night for a year,
carrying
five or six plates. Yeah, I mean, it was pretty ridiculous, but. Then I became friends with the bartender there, Steve Ginsburg, and Steve got me behind the bar. And at the time, it was just a little wine and beer place. And
did you start a bar backing, or did you?
No, I just went right into it. Unfortunately, I went right into bartending. well, I mean, a lot of the really good guys in the industry today have started off as bar backs, so they have that really good background. Me, I was just kind of spoiled going straight into bartending, but. Of course, I left there just as they started to get their full liquor license. So no. I wasn't really making drinks there other than wine and beer. And then I left, and then I went to Benny's Burritos over in the East Village, which was kind of funny. When I started working at Death & Company, I was like, wow, I've kind of come full circle. I'm right down the block from where I got my bartending, where I earned my bartending chops.
Cool. Now that wasn't until a little bit later though, right? I mean, you worked at Pegu Club and you worked with Julie Reiner and Andre Saunders for a little while.
Yeah, that was probably the time when I got into bartending, a little higher end bartending. I mean, I'd worked in different dive bars. I've worked at the Jolly Roger, which I think is now the Thirsty Scholar in the East Village, and I did some time at Boulay. But nothing like what I experienced at Pegu Club. I mean, Pegu Club for me was, one of the best interviews I've ever had in my life, sitting down with Julie and Audrey. And, basically I had read, just before I started working there, I had read Dale's book, The Craft of the Cocktail.
Right.
And literally everything that Audrey was doing there was exactly like right out of Dale's book. Like everything I had read about was going to be available to me.
Essentially the bar manual for that place.
Yeah, it was absolutely amazing. And of course, I had just returned from Hawaii, so Julie and I had a natural connection there. And it was a lot of fun sitting down and talking to those two. And just wasn't an awkward interview, whereas like most of the times it's like you're sitting down with people and yada, 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 you say a bunch of crap. And this was very comfortable. It was much like sitting with you. It was like, okay, cool. Let's just talk about cocktails.
Cool.
And Audrey was really nice and very accommodating.
And you also worked with a lot of like other real, very well-known bartenders these days that are working. They've since gone on to open up some of the other really well-known bars around the city and around the country. And
I mean, as a bartender, honestly, I've lived a very charmed life. I've worked with some of the biggest people, and at least had the pleasure of working with some of the biggest people in the industry and become really good friends with some of them as well. I mean, when I was looking for work, I was working with Jerry Banks, who was a really early, a really tremendous early influence on me. And we were at the Juniper Suite. I had just moved back from Hawaii and she was opening this place, and that fell apart like a house of cards. But she told me that Audrey was getting ready to open Pegu Club. And having moved back, I went, you know, my fiance Cavill and I, we had moved to Hawaii, and then we were in Seattle, and then we came back to New York. So all in all, it was about a year away. And I just felt like the town had totally changed. I was like, where do I go to make great drinks? And I just decided, I was like, okay, out of the blue, I was going to email Dale DeGroff and just say, Dale, I really love your book. I want to do the kind of bartending that you do. How do I get involved? And at the same time, Jerry had told me that Audrey was opening Pegu Club, and she's like, send your resume to Audrey. Well, I did that on the same day, and on the same day, Audrey and Dale exchanged my resumes.
Oh, cool.
So I got an interview with Audrey, but like Jill, Dale's wife, like called me up and she's like, Dale's doing an event. Would you like to come? And I was like, are you serious? Yeah, of course. I'd love to work with Dale. And doing that event, that's where I first met Julie Reiner. And working with Dale was like nothing I had ever seen before. I mean, most of the time when you were a bartender, it was like, so what else do you do? And working with Dale, it was like working with royalty. I mean, I saw people like basically, he's like, do you want to kiss my ring? Like people were just kissing up to him, and he wasn't full of himself at all.
He was the one guy back in the day doing this. He was the guy that brought back, like we talked about earlier in the week, he was the one guy that really started bringing back the classic cocktails and the respect of the cocktail.
We wouldn't be here if it wasn't for Dale.
Right.
I mean, you know, and when Dale was doing it, I don't think Dale was known as a mixologist. I think Dale was known as a bartender. And I mean that in the utmost respect. Like, I think Dale is everything that a bartender is supposed to be. And more so, not only does he make great drinks, but he's just an incredible human being. And that and the charm that he possesses is what makes him great. Same thing with like Murray Stenson. It's like these guys, they not only can bartend circles around most of us, but they could also talk circles around us.
They're right.
Like they're really great with the people that they serve.
You know, an interesting thing that's happening these days, especially with, I kind of feel like there's a third wave of this renaissance of cocktails, a third or fourth wave. And you've got a lot of younger guys and girls are getting into it. And it's nice to see that the quality of cocktails has gone up and the quality of bar service and just the immense amount of knowledge that people have on the subject nowadays. It's really turned it around. And sometimes, you know, like you were just saying, when you told people you're a bartender, they're like, all right, what else do you do? Are you like an artist or a musician?
Right.
Are you going to school? Are you doing something like that? And just speaking of like Dale DeGroff, you know, his son Leo is another very highly respected bartender, and
absolute
he's a
chip off the old block. I couldn't think of a higher compliment than say that Leo is just like his dad.
Yeah, and you know, to me that's a really respectful thing, and it also changes the whole perception of how people look at bartending and how really just in the and. The service industry in general, about how, this is what you do. It's like, what else do you do? Are you a musician or an artist or a writer? Are you in school or what's going on here? But you know, when you have somebody at that respect level of Dale and then his son following in his footsteps, it's like, all right, this is something that you can actually do and do well and make a good living at it and be respected these days.
Absolutely. You know. I mean, you know, and it obviously it goes beyond Dale and Leo. I mean, there's so many people, Julie and Audrey and Sasha and like Phil Ward, Joaquin Simo, Evan Freeman, Toby Cicchini. I mean, there's a million people in this industry that do an amazing job, and they're not just good at making cocktails, they're good at making people feel comfortable when they're at the bar,
because
that seems to be the what people are scolding us these days for is being
that is
being
true
a bunch of snobs,
being a bunch of snobs and a bunch of know-it-alls. And I mean, unfortunately there are some of the younger crowd, I'm not gonna name names, but there are definitely
why not
quite a, well that's for the next
that's
show
not for us.
You know, there are a lot of people out there that are getting into it for reasons that a lot of bartenders like yourself and like Dale and all these people put all this, they laid down the groundwork for a lot of us other bartenders to come in and start out at a higher level than what a lot of you guys did. You know, I mean, I've worked my share of dive bars, but you know, I haven't been doing it as long as a lot of people. And you know, when you get that crowd in that that you know, they want something simple like a amaretto sour, like we were talking about earlier.
Right.
And you say, well, we don't carry amaretto because it blah, blah, blah. Or like, we only carry small batch bourbons and artisanal products. And somebody just wants to come in and have a good time and have a drink. And at the end of the day, that's really what it's about.
Yeah, I mean,
feel comfortable.
People are coming into bars because they either want to drown their sorrows, they want to disappear, they maybe just want to enjoy themselves. And it's like, who are we to make someone feel bad for what they want to drink? I mean, nobody, you shouldn't make somebody feel bad for what they want. I mean, when I was at Pegu Club, I thought it was kind of funny that people would get upset. It was like, oh, they want a vodka tonic, you know. I was like, why get upset at that? I was like, they can pay $11 for a vodka tonic or they can pay $12 for a cocktail. I was like, go ahead, drink your vodka tonic. That's fine. As long as it makes you happy, it's great. The benefit for me is, one, it's a quick drink to make. Two, I get to buy yellow chartreuse. I get to buy Fernet Branca. I get to buy Chenard. I get to buy high batch or high quality bourbons and ryes. I was like, whatever brings money in, whatever makes people happy, that's what we're doing. It's like Gary Regan said, he's like, you know, bottom line is this is a service industry.
Yeah, absolutely.
We're supposed to take care of people. And I mean, I know my friends that are like, yeah, well, Brian, you just stay in service. Like when I worked at Death & Company and Pegu Club. But part of that for me was when I was trying to learn this business and trying to learn the drinks, because the people, you were talking about some of the amazing people I've worked with, the opening staff of Pegu Club was like an all-star game. I mean, it was Jim Meehan, it was Phil Ward, it was Toby Maloney, it was Eric Simpkins, Jim Kearns was there, Sammy Ross was there. There were just amazing bartenders working there, and it was like, just soak up the knowledge from those guys and like learn from them and have fun.
We had also
boys, I'm mellow the honeydew. Yeah.
Hey guys, you're listening to The Speakeasy on the Heritage Radio Network. My guest today has been Brian Miller. We've been talking about bartending in classic bars and bartending around the world and in New York City. And we were just talking about, if you were in fact listening, we were just talking about some of the great bartenders at Pegu Club, where Brian worked for quite a little while before moving on to Death & Company. Let's talk about Death & Company for a little bit.
Wow. Absolutely, positively, the best experience I've ever had behind a bar, from top to bottom, from Dave and Robbie, the owners, to Phil Ward. I mean, there is no Death & Company without Phil Ward, to be honest. No disrespect towards Dave and Robbie, but Phil was, he's the man there. That place wouldn't be the place it was without Phil. And I'm really fortunate to call Phil one of my best friends, and I've learned so much from him. I would probably say two of the people that have been influential to me as far as like, at least like learning recipes and growing as a bartender would be like Toby Maloney at Pegu Club and Phil Ward. Probably Phil more than anything else because I spent 3.5 years with him. I mean, there was a great joke that Phil and I were husband and wife, you know.
Now, both of those guys have moved on to start up, Phil starting Myowell.
Mm-hmm.
Ironically, like a block away.
Yeah, part of the Death and Company family, you know.
Yeah, and then Toby's in, he's at the Violet Hour.
Toby's all over the world. Right. You know, he's, as him and his business partner, Jason Cott, and actually Joaquin, who works at Death and Company as well, changing the cocktail world one day at a time. Those guys, Toby's doing amazing stuff. He's actually, they're kind of branching off towards Middle America, which is a great thing.
Nice.
If we can get Middle America to follow the rest of us on the left and right, then, you know, we'll be all right.
That's funny you bring that up because, recently in certain publications, like, for instance, like Imbibe Magazine and other food publications like Bon Appetit and like Savour, you're starting to see more recipes from bartenders in the Midwest and in like Mid-America and like coming from around places we've never seen before, really. Like St. Louis. There's Austin, Texas, and Houston.
Ted Kilgore is from there, right?
Yeah. Then you've got Mindy Kuchin from Houston at Anvil. You've got Bill down in Austin. You've got some really amazing places.
Kirk Estopinal down in New Orleans now. He went from the Violet Hour down to back home to New Orleans. Great bartender.
You know, we talk a lot about in this industry and this style of bartending and in this culture, we talk a lot about we tend to stay, you know, in certain cities, or we always did. We have a caller. Hold on.
We have a caller?
We do have a caller. Hello?
Yeah, how are you doing?
I'm doing pretty well. How are you?
Say, I have a question about how to make a good drink with moonshine.
With moonshine?
Yeah.
Like real moonshine or this this new wave of clear whiskeys?
No, real moonshine from Pennsylvania, from the Allegheny Hills.
Wow. Oh, cool. I actually have a jug of it at home from around Somerset, Pennsylvania. Brian, you wanna elaborate on that one?
Real moonshine. I gotta be honest, I've never actually had real moonshine. I've had the white whiskey, you know, from different brands and stuff like that. Sometimes when you're coming from a great spirit like that, an old fashioned. I mean, something where you just let this, you know, let the liquor itself shine.
This being like a classic old fashioned, 19th century style, or like a
20th century
style?
not the punk rock with the orange and the cherry or something like that. But yeah,
about sugar bitters,
sugar bitters, you know, orange and lemon twist, maybe a little demerara sugar in there, something like that. Just keeping it simple because the spirit is really what you want to shine. You don't want to like overpower it or anything like that.
Not to ever shine, like meaning more of the shine or less of the shine compared to the mixer that goes with it.
Well, less is more. I mean, you can look at a classic cocktail like an old fashioned, and it's like it's a little bit of sugar, it's a spirit, it's got bitters, perhaps an orange and a lemon twist on it. You want to taste the moonshine, but you want to kind of accentuate the positives that are in the spirit. You don't want to throw something heavy on there, either a lot of sugar or cranberry or orange juice, where you don't even get to taste the moonshine. I mean, what's the point of doing a great spirit like that when you're just going to cover it up with something else?
I would also like to interject here that if it is real old school moonshine, You might want to dilute it a little bit before you start mixing it, because that stuff can burn you up on the insides. It can be quite dangerous.
My friends in my immediate facility that I go club with, they're worried about going blind.
that's a fair concern. Like we were saying before, it would be best to dilute it before you start drinking, because it can really with a fears of going blind. It's more about the impurities in the distillation, because you've got the heads and the tails from the distillate that contain more congeners and impurities that can actually be harmful to you. So just be careful with that. And when you mix it, like I said, mix it carefully. You don't want your house to explode. All right, thanks a lot.
Thank you. Great show.
Thanks
man. Bye.
Brian, I'd like to talk to you a little bit more about some of these cocktails and the future of like where you're going with this. A lot of people don't really maybe know of you as, I mean, people that know
I
you.
I hope not.
Know of you as a big guy into tiki drinks, but you happen to be very involved in the tiki culture, and these are drinks that a lot of people haven't yet regained respect for because of the fact that they think it's just a bunch of different rums mixed with a bunch of different juices. And
I think it's people selling. I mean, if you have that kind of mentality towards tiki drinks, I think you're selling those drinks short. Tiki is, that's the best to explain this. I mean, it's kind of like Don the Beachcomber said, he's like, what one rum can't do, three can. And it's not about just making an overpowering drink that makes that gets people drunk. The Zombie is one of the more complex drinks out there. It's probably my favorite drink, and it was one of those things where several years ago I saw an interview with Jeff Beachbum Berry in the New York Times, and he was like, you can't get a decent zombie in New York. And I was like, well, that's kind of insulting. I was like, well, maybe we should do something about this. And I was fortunate enough to get an opportunity to work with Lynette Marrero, and she was consulting on a restaurant called El Ataria. And they asked me to be involved, and it was mostly like Indian food. And I was like, okay, well, I'm gonna go with rum, and I'm gonna try to pair the Indian food with tiki drinks. And I was dead set on trying to figure out how I was going to make a zombie. I read Beachbum Berry's book, Sip and Safari, which in my humble opinion is probably one of the greatest cocktail books ever written, not only just for the recipes, but the stories of the people that were involved in that movement. And I decided I was going to make a zombie, and I did everything I could to like figure out, I followed Beachbum Berry's recipe, but I just used the rums that were available to me here. And thankfully it was a success, and I ended up bringing it back to Death & Company. And, but it's one of those drinks that's like, there's so many layers to it. And just like other drinks, I mean, at Death & Company, we had the QB Cooler. I've served the Mai Tai there. I've done whatever I can as far as tiki drinks. I've tried to make them there. And I think one of the nicest things was Joaquin Simo, who I work with. He was like, at one point Death & Company probably was the best tiki bar in New York City. And I was like, well, that's pretty cool. I mean, those guys, God, they have the patience of saints, because, you know, I would make those drinks and those guys would like get customers that would ask them for it and be like, oh God, here's one of Brian's like 12 ingredient drinks. You know, I don't really want to have to do this.
The first one that comes to mind is the Winchester, which is not only one of the first drinks I actually had at Death & Company, but, it's one of your original zombie variations, which actually uses a few different kinds of gin, a little bit of Saint Germain.
Yeah, it was my second attempt at trying to do a tiki cocktail. I mean, I was really intimidated to try to create a tiki cocktail, especially with so many great ones out there that haven't been replicated in bars. But thankfully, there are a lot of people out there now that are doing tiki or tiki-esque type drinks. Giuseppe Gonzalez and Richie Picado at Painkiller. Julie Reiner working with Joe Swifka at Lonnie Kai.
Who you actually worked with at
El Ataria. Yeah, I trained Joe at El Ataria. Joe came in and he was just so eager. He was kind of like one of those guys that like really, in a way, it was kind of like myself. Like, he really wanted to do good cocktails, but he wasn't in an environment to do it. So it was like handing him the tools to actually do great cocktails. Joe just like took off. I mean, he does. I think it's still on the menu at Lonnie Kai, but the Black Pearl was really one of my favorite drinks that Joe did. God, it had, I mean, how can you go wrong? It had like rum and Old Forester's bourbon in it. So great drink. And Julie has always, you know, with her passion, her history coming from Hawaii and her passion for drinks, she does amazing stuff there. And it's so nice to see that coming around, because for me, it was like Tiki was the last original cocktail movement, you know, in the United States, and now it's kind of having a renaissance.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing that when we think about like mixology and like the origins of cocktails, we think about the 19th century, and we think about guys like Jerry Thomas, and we think about anyone from Jerry Thomas to Harry Johnson and Charles H. Baker, like this
right.
19th century, earlier 20th century, these guys who wrote all these original cocktail books. You got Jacques Schraub, you've got Robert Vermeer, all these guys. We think about them as being the main creators of all the classic cocktails. Then you get into the early 1930s, and you've got Don the Beachcomber and Trader Vic just going crazy with this stuff, and in a completely different style. And I think these drinks being fun and very tasty and not a bunch of whiskey that's hard to take down for most people, they're still very potent, just very, very like on the sweeter side. I would say more on the fruit forward side, but there's more layers to that than I think have been respected in the last couple of decades. It's been kind of botched in a way. People think of these drinks as like, you know, half blue curacao and blended. But when you look at drinks like you were just saying, like with a zombie, with so many different layers and so many ingredients, really, and things like the Caribbean punch, for instance, I mean, it's got absinthe, almond extract, it's got sarsaparilla in it. It's
right,
so absolutely. Many different layers. Yeah. It's one of my favorite
absolutely.
Tiki cocktails. And the way that these drinks are built, I mean, it's just these minuscule measurements, these like just tiny little bits and pieces of different ingredients to make this one amazing flavor that's balanced the right way and just multi-layered. And
I think people think that like maybe they're too hard to make, that they're too difficult. You know, it's like, oh, there's 12 ingredients. So it's like, look, I've worked with some really great bartenders, and we've done crazy things. When I was at Death & Company, it was like, oh, we're going to have a flip menu with like six different flips on there. Or we're going to put the Queen's Park Swizzle, you know, which can be a labor-intensive drink. We're going to put that on the menu. Bartenders, if they are pushed to, you know, go the extra mile and work hard on drinks, they will do it. They'll become really fast at it. I mean, the guys at Death & Company really, I feel, have like pushed the boundaries of like what they can get away with serving to customers, when most people are like, man, I don't want to make a Queen's Park Swizzle. It's like the swizzling and the bitters and blah, blah, blah. I was like, well, they started doing that at Milk & Honey. And, you know, we put it on the menu at Death & Company, and flips with eggs and cream and what a sticky mess. It's like, Joaquin has looked at me several times and been like, really, Brian, 12 ingredients, we're putting the QB cooler with a half a teaspoon of ginger syrup in there. He's like, come on, man, can you do anything to make my life more difficult? I'm like, I probably could if you gave me time. You know, I could find another tiki drink that would be difficult. But the blending, I mean, it really kind of adds to the mystique of like bartenders, like being able to blend a drink and have it perfectly balanced. I mean, honestly, I wouldn't be as passionate about tiki drinks if it wasn't for people like, I mean, I'm sorry to name drop and stuff like that, but Jeff Barry and Martin Kate, I mean, those are two guys that are like seminal characters in the tiki world. Martin is beyond belief. I think what Martin does is he takes, at Smuggler's Cove, it's like he takes tiki drinks, he does the standards and the classics, but then he also does a twist. You know, it's like a tiki drink doesn't have to be four different juices and three different rums. You can use different spices, you know, use the things that Don the Beachcomber has created, like Don spices and Don's mix, you know, whether it's 1, 2, 3, 7, whichever ones, you know, and Beach Bum Barry, who's basically unearthed all of this for us. It's like he dug up a relic and was like, hey, here you go.
Yeah, and Beach Bum Barry just recently came out with a book. He had The Grog Log and Intoxica and Sippin' Safari.
Taboo Table.
He had all these books that he had previously put out over the last, a little bit over a decade, yes?
Mm-hmm.
Just came out with a book called Remixed.
Mm-hmm.
And it's basically like a compendium of a lot of these recipes.
His first two books, The Grog Log and Intoxica, is like a combination of those two books.
But also adding into that some of the more modern recipes. In fact, you have a couple, two or three recipes in Remixed, right?
Probably, probably the highlight of my limited career is being in his books. But not only myself, but like a bunch of other bartenders from across the globe, their new recipes for tiki drinks, which are amazing. I mean, I think it's kind of funny that Europe is so much farther ahead in the tiki culture than the United States is. And I was like, it was born here, you know? It's like somebody doing blues and jazz better than the United States. It's kind of embarrassing. It's like, why haven't we picked this up? And maybe, you know, people today think that tiki is a trend, and I hope it's not, you know, I hope it's here to stay. I mean, I'm really passionate about it. I think it's a great thing. I think it's a nice alternative to the backlash that you and I have talked about, that people today are like, oh, bartenders are snobs and they're elitists and they're making cocktails hard for other, you know, it's hard for people to get a drink without feeling bad. And like, I don't think that tiki incorporates that. I think tiki is all about fun.
Absolutely.
It's all about rum. And people talk about, oh, well, what about classic cocktails? I was like, man, I've seen a lot of great classic drinks redone with rum. I will say one of my favorite new classic rum drinks is doing a Negroni with rum. Joaquin did it at Death & Company. It was Smith & Cross, Antica, and Campari. And it's freaking fantastic, nice. You know, because Smith & Cross is a bull in a china shop.
Yeah,
you know,
it sure stand is. Up anything. It's great, but you're right.
It is.
Also, correct me if I'm wrong, but didn't Joaquin Simo also come up with the Latin Quarter?
Latin Quarter, yeah.
Which is another good...
Absolutely.
Rum drink, a classic. It's a Sazerac variation with a Zacapa rum.
Yeah.
It's an amazing drink.
It's a fantastic drink. I mean, in some ways, I kind of chase after Joaquin. He does really good things. When he was coming up with the Kingston Negroni, which is his Smith & Cross Negroni, I was working on something called the East India Trading Company, which was like another Negroni with sherry. His Latin Quarter, I did something that was kind of like that. God, I can't even remember the name, but it was like it was the same thing. It was a Sazerac, but with a little bit of rum and pear. And Joaquin and I both kind of have like a love for rum. He's incredibly knowledgeable. And I don't know, when I think about all the people talking about how bartenders are mean and snotty, you just haven't met Joaquin.
That's right.
I mean, absolutely, you know, not to kiss anybody's butt. Well, maybe a little bit. But Joaquin and I think Jim Meehan are two of the nicest people that I've ever met behind a bar, like consistently, like just genuinely good people. They'll tell you the history of anything ad nauseum, but they'll also just kind of smile at you and make you laugh.
Yeah. Now, we were talking earlier about these guys like Phil and this being Phil Ward, mm-hmm. Dobie, these guys branching off to do their own thing. Now, you've been talking a little bit here and there about possibly opening up a bar soon.
Yeah. I mean, it's something that I've definitely thought about. I would like to, I think, open my own place. Currently, the way the market is, it's making it a little tough for me to open my own place. I mean, I have a possible investor and I have an idea, but you know, those things, sometimes they kind of fade. I mean, I would like to open a tiki bar, but maybe have I missed the boat, you know? I mean, other people are out there doing it already. Giuseppe and Julie and God, today I even read about some place called Riff Raff, you know, it's like a tiki club thing. They're already doing it. I don't know. I'd like to think that the world could sustain another tiki bar and hopefully it would be mine. I don't know. But I mean, God, to be perfectly honest with you, am I bar owner material? I don't know. I mean, you read books like Harry Johnson, you know, when he talks about it, it's like, look, just because you can make great drinks doesn't mean you're going to be a great bar owner. And I guess that thought kind of hovers in the back of my head. Like, am I really the guy to like open a bar? But
for me now, having stepped away from Death and Company, I just miss bartending.
Yeah.
I just miss serving people. I mean, in my life, it's never been about me. It's always been about the customer.
Right on. And you know what? Hanging out with you, being on the other side of the bar, and flip-flop when I'm behind the bar and talking to you about this stuff. And I'm sure that all of our listeners are picking up on this, but I, you know, you talk so well about all these other guys that you've worked with over the past, and you know, like Joaquin and Jim and all these guys, and how great they are, and how good at like the actual like act of service and bartending and the creativeness, and they've got like the whole package. I just wanted to say, you know, that I don't think I, like, personally, I don't think I could be in a position that I'm in as a bartender without having run into guys like you guys. Be it at Death & Company or just out at events, working, like, just very closely with you guys and learning so much, not only about, like, drinks and history and the quality of ingredients and technique and everything, but just seeing how well received the customers that are at your bars are. And it's just been, it's been an amazing pleasure to talk to you and have you as a guest on the show.
Thanks for having me, Damon. I appreciate it.
Really. My guest today has been Brian Miller. This has been The Speakeasy on Heritage Radio. Tune in next week where my guest will be Thomas Waugh, head bartender of Death & Company.
Kick ass.
Thanks, Brian.
Thank you, David.
Thanks for listening. That cat is high. My boobie. Look at that look in his eye, baby.